We are live. I'm in my office sitting on my couch with Stacy Pressman.
Hi, everybody.
Stacy.
How to be Tom Shalhoub. A podcast starring me, Tom Shalhoub. Each week, I explore a topic or speak with someone I find interesting. Someone I think you could learn from. By listening, you might gain some insight into what it's like to be Tom Shalhoub. Now, why would anybody want to do that? Well, look, you have to model yourself after someone, right? Might as well be me. I mean, who are you going to be, Albert Einstein? Much easier to start with someone simple, like me, Tom Shalhoub.
You are, I don't want to say you're a contemporary of mine because we, you know, had worked together, but like, it's not like you started with me. You're younger than me, Stacy.
A little bit. I started a little later than most of my friends. I started like in my later 20s, early 30s. Well, you know.
Well, I did too. I mean, I want to do your history because, you know, one of my favorite things when I'm talking to fellow comics is, you know, getting their origin story, because it's not the kind of thing that I ever go over. Like when I'm, you know, you don't learn about this when you're hanging out with comics.
No.
You know, you usually don't know how, you know, all of the stuff they had to do to break into the business. I came from Boston. I started in basically theme parks. I started singing in a barbershop quartet and then, you know, wound my way through the world of like summer entertainers. And then I ended up doing improv. And then, of course, I was around comedians. So I started stand-up in Boston. Then I went to Florida. Then I moved to New York. And that's when I met guys like Jim Gaffigan and Geraldo and people like that. But let me get your journey. Where were you? Where did you start?
I'm from originally a native New Yorker from Brooklyn, New York. I started in the theater. I did a lot of plays in a few films before I even touched the stand-up mic.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. It was, I was in a show called Grandma Sylvia's Funeral off Broadway for about 4 years.
Oh my gosh. I remember that was such a, there were Grandma Sylvia's Funeral. That's the original, because then they had like Benny's Bar Mitzvah and like, you know, Joey's funeral or whatever, right?
Well, Tony and Tina's Wedding was the original, and then we came next. But we were mostly scripted, and we had like really interesting like guest stars in our show. We had like Mary Wilson from The Supremes, Lee Merriweather. We had like some serious actors, you know, and performers that
in the permanent cast, or they were just special guests.
They would stay for like 3 or 4 months. No one wanted to leave. It was like the easiest gig. It was fun. It was like 2 hours, you're in and out. It was a full-time job. You know, I was in my 20s and I was like working as an actress full-time and then doing films on alternate days, you know, and it was great for me.
Wow.
You know,
what was that? What years was that?
Those were the mid to late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the Van Damme, the Soho Playhouse, which was the Van Damme Playhouse at the time on Van Damme Street.
Yep.
Where they do comedy and one-man shows now. I always see they have an upstairs and a downstairs. It used to just be an upstairs.
Right.
And so we had the show. We had 8 shows a week. And I was really proud to be in the show. And, you know, we had a lot of media attention and all kinds of crazy stuff happened. And then the show closed. They wanted to leave with a bang because we were open for many years. And Jackie Mason had suggested I should do stand-up.
Wow.
I met him during my run in the show because he was doing his one man show on Broadway.
Yep.
And we sort of had like, you know, all these like actors equity had a lot of like bowling events and flea markets. And we had the Easter Bonnet competition on Broadway. So we had all this sort of mixture of socialization. And Jackie took to our show because it had a Jewish orientation, right? It had a Jewish theme. So Jackie said, well, you know, you're funny. You should do stand up. I'm like, okay. So the show closed. In a couple of years, I met Rick Shapiro, who is one of my dear friends. And he's like, all right, I'll help you do stand up and I'll teach you how to write a little bit. And I said, okay. And next thing I knew, I was doing stand up.
Wow. And so where Rick was big, like Rick would do the Cellar and he did a lot of the downtown clubs. What were the spaces that you would play?
Well, I started producing rooms like immediately. That was like my thing. I'm like, if I'm going to get on stage, I'm going to do it on my own volition. So I did some of the open mics, but then I would, you know, take these rooms like where the first stand comedy club was on Third Avenue. It was a place called Proof and I had a room there downstairs. It was like similar. I remember that. So I did all these little rooms I produced and stand up New York. You might have been on some of my shows.
Yep.
Something called the Great American Trash Bash. It was about freedom of speech. And I did that. Patrice O'Neill was in that. Jim Norton, Gaffigan, Voss. It was really fun. So I was a young comic producing. And then I just started doing the road and doing here and there and everywhere. And
yeah.
That's how it happened. That was my origin story.
Right. Yeah, so that's why when I'm thinking of you, I said we didn't start together, but I feel like you were a contemporary of mine, but that's really like the second decade of mine. Like in the early 2000s, when I was running around, that's probably when I would be popping in and doing your shows or things like that.
Yeah, definitely. And I remember seeing you around. I know you did my stand-up New York shows.
Yeah.
I did a lot of those. And I used to be married to a comedian named Tim Homayoun, which you probably know him.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, I think you did the road with him. And I would tag along when I was first started and I would do a guest spot on a lot of these shows. So I wanted like, I know this sounds crazy and this is probably the antithesis of stand-up, but I actually kind of went into comedy, A, because I wanted to do comedy and B, because I wanted to make money, which is weird, right? Because people feel acting is making money, but I felt like, well, you can make your own shows and charge, you can make something, you know? So I started doing stand-up to make money, which is so weird because I wish I kept doing that.
I know. Well, it really is a blue collar profession because when you're starting out, you're like, you just want to get to that point of where you can make $300. Like if somebody would, like, I remember in the 90s thinking, because guys like Steve Marshall, you know, Steve Marshall's like, oh,
very good friend of mine. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And
mentor
so Steve,
of mine back then. Yeah.
Right. He was a mentor because he's the kind of guy who would love to talk to you after the gig. You know, he would say, you know, he would talk about his, you know, the way that he built his career. And he loved talking to young comics about how they're going to build their career. But I remember Steve Marshall saying, oh, I'm making 300 on Friday. I'm making 300 on Saturday. I was thinking like, what? He's making $600 on the weekend? Like
that was a lot of money, you know. And you, I don't think the some of these gigs they haven't really gone up.
Yeah, I know. Just a couple hundred.
Really, I mean, you know, you have to kind of some of these. I'm like these older bookers from the road. I'm like, things have changed a little bit, you know. And I'm not going to pay my opener $50, you know.
Yeah, I know. It's really amazing. But so that being said. To an actor, the steady gigs of a comedian really is pretty good pay because, you know, with an acting life, I was in the city and running around and I was always auditioning and I always wanted to be in shows like Forbidden Broadway. I would audition for. I always wanted one of those shows like you had. I wanted to kind of have that thing. But even then, you're not making killer money, right? I mean, you're making a living.
It was barely equity. Actors' equity, and I'm not going to knock them, but, you know, there are times when – even like in more recent years, they're like someone had offered me a show and it was a lot more money than equity would have paid. And, you know, I had to like, I actually sort of had issues with actors equity, you know, and it, you know, on Broadway, you know, you do make a decent limit on Broadway, but off Broadway, which is a legitimate contract, 8 shows a week, the pay isn't great. It's not that great. Yeah.
So
you can make more money on a weekend, you know, in Tulupa.
So you're the show's over because it's not the 90s anymore. Now it's the early 2000s, and you're booking shows and you're kind of running your own shows and maybe doing some road gigs and things like that. But are you doing something else? Do you have like a support job? Are you waiting tables and things like that?
No, I never waited tables. I did some interesting work. I did. I did shoe modeling. I did foot fetish work back then.
What did you do? They photograph you?
No, they would like touch my feet and be paid for it. It was like, you know, it was a very odd work.
Wow. Like where would you have to put your feet that they would touch them?
In their mouth. And
oh my God. And what is it, a broker? Like, do they, you would
no, go- there's no pimp. There's no foot pimp, really, like sort of a pimp. They'd have these parties at Hellfire during happy hour. And they would ask women that were, you know, to come that had nice feet or feet, you know, didn't have to have nice feet. And feet. You can go, I'm on WikiFeet. And, you know, people would pay you about $20 for 10 minutes. It wasn't like an everyday job. So I wasn't like in the life, as they say, but it was like once every month or so. So I'd make my rent, you know, and it was fun. I mean, I did different things. I did a lot of producing. I did the foot. I actually did shoe modeling too, and foot work, foot fetish work. So I guess my feet have been through it all. And yes. I still did a little acting work in between, and I had some sales jobs in there. And I sort of like finagled around that. But yeah, I worked quite a lot in the beginning. The producing started paying off. I did speaking. That's what happened. So in the like 2003-04, yep. Mikey Stefano, may he rest in peace, great comedian Mikey D, he had suggested that I do speaking because I had an eating disorder and I was recovered and his agency needed a speaker on eating disorders. So he said, will you come and interview with them? I said, sure. And I paid like, you know, a couple $1,000 a lecture and that's what I was doing.
Wow. So Mike had a connection to this. Did he do speaking as well?
Yeah, he did. He spoke about his story, about his recovery story and his
Let's HIV talk status. About Mike. I mean, because he had I learned this through his stand-up, and I actually sat down with him, and I offered to direct his one-man show because he had such a great story. And I said, Mike, you got to get in the theater, and if you do, I will direct your show. And he was like, I don't even know where to begin. Like, he was like, I just got to do my stuff in stand-up. And I was like, no, your story is a theater show, you know?
It is. It was great. It was amazing.
He was a tough guy. He did drugs. His wife contracted AIDS, am I right? And then he never contracted AIDS.
He was HIV positive, but it became non-detectable. Uh-huh. And he talked about that at the colleges. Like, you know, the funniest thing, Mike and I would be at the Southeastern Panhellenic Conference. That's like every sorority in the South. Okay. Yes. So it's Mikey D, guy from the Bronx, girl from Brooklyn, doing lectures on eating disorders and HIV and addiction to Southern women that were in Greek life, you know, or sororities, you know, for those that don't know, but it was insane. We were able to relate our stories to them. You know, not that, you know, they were very like different than the way we grew up, you know, very sort of proper and prim and everyone was dressed to the nines. And Mikey D and I would come out and he did his lecture. I did my lecture. It was like, it was funny, you know, but we were able to convey these messages of healing, recovery, and hope to, you know, people from all walks of life.
Yeah.
And Mikey D was one of the best at it, I have to say.
He was great. And he was an incredible comic. And he was you know, back in those Patrice days and everything, like he was one of those comics who would just work. He'd come in late night. He would work the crowd. He would talk about race. He would talk about all things that made people uncomfortable, but he was able to do it in such a brilliant way. And he had such respect among his comics. And then finally, we both did the kind of show that neither of us were really comfortable doing, but both Mike and I did Last Comic Standing together.
Oh, right. Right. I remember that. Yes.
And so, you know, and I went there and you have to audition. I had to audition in front of Geraldo, you know?
Oh, that's so funny. I know. Oh, may he rest in peace. He was a brilliant comic too.
Yeah. But of course, and he's just doing it for the money. He being a judge, you know, and he feels terrible that he's got his essentially peers. I mean, I wasn't on his level of success at the time, but we had started together and then I got to come out and do Last Comic Standing and audition Geraldo, you know? But he and Andy Kindler.
Oh, right. Everyone, we all were. I remember, I mean, I've worked with those guys as a younger comic and then having to judge each other was very bizarre. Yeah. It was a way to get exposure and make money, I guess, right?
Yeah. And so everyone has the same agreement. We're like all doing this. Nobody really wants to do it, but, you know, we did it. So then I did the first round and Mike and I both went in thinking we're not going to even get through this. You know, they're not going to pick us. But then we went through the first round and then we went to the show at night at Gotham. And then we got passed to Vegas or whichever, Vegas or LA. I can't remember which one we went to. but we had to fly out. And so, you know, we were staying in the hotel together and we were just kind of laughing about it. And he was kind of, you know, now he was my competitor. Like he had to beat me and he's like, I'm going to beat you, Shalu, you know? So it was this kind of fun competition, but we couldn't really take it seriously.
Yeah, that's, yeah, I remember that. I totally forgot about the last Comic Standing days and cheering my friend on and being excited about it. Yeah, it was like, cause I knew everybody on the show. It's like, I hope, you know,
yeah.
It's like, I remember the season of Michelle Ballin and you guys, and it just was so cool.
That's right. And I, in the end, you know what happened with me? I ended up only getting to you know, Vegas or LA, whichever that one was. It was LA. Because we shot it in like Burbank or something like that. And they cut me out of the whole show. So like,
oh wow.
I was killed in LA, you know, at the semifinals or whatever. Right. And I think Mike went on from there, the semifinals.
Yeah, he went to like the last five or something. Or
yes.
He was a runner up or something. Or did he win? I don't know. He didn't win.
No, but he was, and I forget who won that year, but yeah, Mike was definitely he went further than me. And then when I went to look at it, because I was thinking like, oh, whenever they cut you, they make you look bad. And then they cut you out of the show and they make it look like you had the worst set of your life, even though like all of your sets were the same.
Yeah, I remember them doing that to some people. They would like put them in these like vignettes and like of like two lines of their act. And there was no punchline because they would cut the punchline out and they would mess with people's acting.
The audience and they just show a shot of them waiting. When there was no comic on stage, it's like they fake it up completely and they make it look like you bomb. So I thought that was what was going to happen to me, but I tuned in and they didn't even show me. Like they didn't show my original audition. They didn't show my Gotham set. They didn't show my Los Angeles set. So basically at some point they decide on a narrative. And if I didn't fit their narrative, you know, to be honest, I bet I didn't bomb badly enough on the show.
You probably did well. Right. You probably did well and you didn't bomb. So what are they going to do? Oh, this funny guy didn't get to the next level.
Yeah. And I didn't, there was no film of me being like, I really need this. And like, you know, when you get like the personalities that they just want to, you know, they want to succeed and they want to play up the drama of the story. I'm not a very dramatic individual. So I think that I just didn't fit their thing. So they were like, just cut him out of the whole show.
Right. I mean, everyone had to be a character or like do something crazy or be really bad. It was like, it was a bizarre group of people. The show got kind of worse after the first couple of seasons. I couldn't watch it anymore, but.
Yeah, I know. When it first came on, I was like, oh, this is going to be terrible. You know, a comedian contest. But of course, the first few seasons were kind of fun. And then it made you think like, oh, why didn't I do that? I should have auditioned for it. But, you know, this yeah, exactly.
We go through different things. I know. Luckily, and then it's worse if they would have taken your set and mushed it together some weird way. And
you just don't want to, you don't want to do anything. But I had signed a secrecy agreement though. So I couldn't even tell people that like you're not allowed to tell people you're going to be on the show or whatever. And then so then it came and then you know I was able to just, you know, write it off and if it never happened.
Well, that's probably good.
yeah So now it's the early 2000s, so that's still now we're in 2023, so we're like talking about 20 years. Now what do you do from there? Like, what was the next thing? Because I look at my career in phases. Like, I get to New York, I'm working as a waiter, and then I'm just running around trying to break in. And that's when I like was working with guys like Gaffigan, and we're just basically doing open mic nights and things like that. And then I did Conan in 99, and that was kind of a good breakthrough for
me. That's great.
Yeah, like TV. And then all of the 2000s were like, you know, struggling to get like Comedy Central exposure, you know, just get on TV. And then late in the 2000s, like 2009, eight or nine, I started touring with Gaffigan. So that added a new, you know,
that's great. Yeah.
Yeah. The career thing of and going on the tour, playing the big theaters with Jim, getting, you know, good hotel rooms, good money, like eating steaks with Jim. So that was like a whole phase of my career. And our wives were friends, Jeannie Gaffigan and my wife and our kids. So we would kind of meet up in Vegas and have dinner and things like that. So that was my Jim Gaffigan phase. So what happened after you got some success working as a stand-up? You know, what were the moments after that?
There were a few little moments. The speaking was really lucrative and fun. And then I'd be doing, you know, weekend gigs all over this tri-state area and you know, far away too, you know, all kinds of things. College, I did the college market for a while. Then I got married and then divorced. So like once I got divorced, I got really into the podcasting world.
Yeah.
So it was weird. I got a radio job with Reverend Bob Levy and we were in Boston, a real terrestrial radio. So what happened was Artie Lang was on these two stations. When Artie Lang's DirecTV show, I'm skipping like 4 years, but yeah, basically I was just like doing comedy for like 4 or 5 years from 2009, 2007, eating disorder lectures, comedy. And then I got deeply into the podcast because I had done Howard Stern when I was younger. Mm-hmm. I was like a guest 3 or 4 times. So I was like in that world.
Yeah.
Hence Grandma Sylvia's funeral. There was a connection because Steve Grillo, who had been one of the interns, was in the show with me and we stayed friends. So I kind of stayed in that world somehow.
Yeah.
In the radio world, the shock jock radio world. And then, when Artie Lang had a DirecTV show, he would broadcast the audio through terrestrial radio. It was like this libertarian radio station that came out of Boston and Washington, D.C.
Yep.
So Bob Levy asked me to host with him this like 3-hour-a-day show. And so I got this radio job, which I didn't know what I was doing, but we had to be there for hours and hours to record. We did it out of Bob's house, but it was like a very intense few days of just recording these 3-hour shows.
We're actually 42 minutes. And you're co-hosting with Reverend Bob Levy.
And Joe Conte, thank God. His friend Joe Conte, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, me and just, I would stay at Bob's house. I would come downstairs. I had my own room, stay at his house, come downstairs at 6 a.m, do hours of radio. And then I'd go back to New York City.
Yeah.
Like, I'd stay sometimes or I'd leave after 3 shows and then come back. It was insane. So I did that for a few months. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty interesting. You know, you'd have to watch every word we said because it was terrestrial radio. Couldn't say anything. And it wasn't like serious, but you could say anything. It was, you know, it was clean radio.
Right.
And it's Bob Levy. But we had some interesting guests on, you know, we had all the comedians on. It was fun. We had a great time. It was really, really fun. It was called Ears Wide Open.
And was that kind of also a quasi-podcast? Were you podcasting it as well as doing the radio or no?
I don't know if we started podcasting it, but Bob started podcasting it after the guy that owned it like ran away and didn't pay us at the last, you know, with some crazy story.
Yes.
I didn't. And so I think Bob started doing a podcast from there and then it kind of just faded away. And Bob's still obviously podcasting, but it was just a crazy experience. It was like Alex Jones and Dennis Miller on the station, Jay Moore, like a lot of Fox guys. You know, it was a very interesting kind of group of people.
Yeah.
And me and Reverend Bob Levy, such a weird, like, the posters are hysterical.
Yeah.
I have to look for UFC or something. Some weird, it was like on AM. It was funny. It was at night. We took, and you know, Artie Lang had been there, so why not Reverend Bob Levy?
Right. So when that ended, then what? Then you were like, okay, now I got to start doing this on my own. Did you start podcasting that?
Yeah, I did the Pressman Hour for many years. I ended it around the pandemic when I was running for mayor, which we'll get into.
Yes.
And I started guesting weekly on Artie Lang's podcast. I did that around 2015-16. And then I started doing Compound Media shows and I did Red Eye with you. So I just started doing different, all kinds of podcasting and radio. And, you know, then I did more and more comedy. Then I just started doing the road a lot more.
Yeah.
And then the big P happened.
The what?
The big P, the pandemic.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, that was ridiculous, but it's funny because I mean, a lot of people started podcasting during the pandemic, right? Because they were like, they were out of work. They were home. That's all they could do.
Yeah, I did. I did a lot of podcasting and then I sort of switched gears because I started doing political podcasts, libertarian.
Yeah.
I was guests on all these libertarian podcasts, like Larry Sharpe's podcast. I mean, he was the person who sponsored me to sort of become the mayoral candidate for the party. But, and, you know, I would do all these little podcasts that I never heard of. And just, it was, I just, you know, did my own podcast. I just did one called Deep for a while. I interviewed people one-on-one. And I just kind of, I got burnt out on doing my own podcast, I guess. Yeah. So I'm doing a new one actually called The Pressman Universe in the end of February. I'm starting it, but you know, I needed a break for a little while. So,
yeah. And on your politics, were you always libertarian or were you political from the beginning?
I wasn't super duper political at all. I actually was kind of like, I was more of an animal activist. I was an activist for different things I believed in.
Yeah.
So I didn't really take party sides, but I always
had animal rights. So you were animal rights. That's considered like left. That's kind of like, I would think a lot of libertarians are like on the polar opposite of the animal rights people, right?
You know, libertarians are very interesting because they can be very left and they can be very right.
Yeah.
But they believe in personal freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So like we would have these libertarian meetups and some people were all over the map, but we were able to have discussions with you know, knowing that we all believed in our civil rights and our human rights and our liberties. So that came first, at least in my view. Like for the Libertarian Party, our civil liberties and our human rights and our freedom come first. So I can talk to you about what you believe. You can talk about what I believe. So just don't tread on me, so to speak.
And would you say, you know, what would you say, what marks would you give to the Libertarian Party during the pandemic? I don't know. I really am not involved in libertarian politics, but I will say that I feel like that would have been an opportunity for the libertarians to rise up. Like if there was ever time for the Libertarian Party to actually make inroads with the American public, it should have been during the pandemic. But I mean, I don't know if the needle moved at all. I feel like they could have been the superheroes of the pandemic. I went to Reason magazine all during the pandemic and they weren't even talking about the incredible
lockdowns and all that.
The absolute, I mean, every once in a while they had a thing here or there, whatever. But I felt like that was one of the biggest surprises to me. I would be going to Reason magazine hoping that they would be declaring what was happening in the country was the worst literally the worst assault on liberty ever in our country's history.
And now we're learning all these things. And it was, we had a huge amount of policy. My campaign, you know, for those people that don't know, I ran for mayor in 2021. I was a libertarian candidate.
Was it because of the pandemic?
The idea was in my head from years before, but the pandemic pushed, you know, kicked me in the butt. Mm-hmm. Like I didn't think I would ever be able to run on any party. Like just to get on the ballot alone, the general ballot is a challenge. You know,
How do you do it? You got tell me that guy again that came to you. Who was the guy that came to you and wanted you to run?
Larry Sharp. He ran for governor.
Yep.
Twice, and he's a brilliant gentleman. Larry Sharp, check him out. He has Sharp Way. He has Larry Sharp. He has all kinds of he's a very smart gentleman. Yep. Really great for the Libertarian Party, I think. One of the best. Has all these solutions to problems. Like, I'm this person that has, if I see a problem, I want to create a solution. With civil liberties in mind and freedom of speech in mind, but I always want to create solutions to problems. And I go right for that. Politics, unfortunately, are politics, right? People want to, you know, you have to find party lines and you have to, you know, make sure you're not going rogue and all that stuff, as they say. And I kind of get what that means now, because you have to sort of stay on the, you know, on the path of what your party believes in, whatever it might be. So, but when the pandemic happened, I felt like I had all these shows. I mean, I was really excited about big shows. I was like, they're all closed.
Yep.
I was like, they were all closed. Obviously, you know, theaters I had worked, I was starting to get more, like the last show I did had 600 to 800 people and I was getting frustrated. You know, I was really working hard and it was so frustrating to see that just happen. You know, I was working consistently and making more money. And it was like, finally, I'm making money as a comedian. Right. Everything closed. And I got depressed, but I also said I'm going to run for mayor. And I declared in April of 2020. And from then on, it just, I got a team together. Larry helped me. He was the head of my team. I had a campaign manager. And we got together. We wrote policy and policy and policies out. I would go to the debates. There was tons of debates I had to go to, ran by different, you know, special interest groups. I debated our mayor many times. Eric Adams and I were in the same debate and everybody else I was running. So it was very interesting. I mean, and I got to really express our political views. And people agreed with me. That was crazy thing.
So running for mayor, you had what? You had a Republican, Democrat, Libertarian.
And a bunch of indies. Yeah, a lot of independent people.
Yeah.
The Democratic race was very intense, the primaries. But I, you know, I already won my primary with the party. So the Democratic primaries was very significant. And I thought I'd be running against Yang, who I now am friendly with. I love Yang. He's became like friends with me. But he didn't win, and so Eric Adams won, and they essentially declared him mayor before the election, really. Or, you know, they were like, the next mayor, you know.
Yeah, he really was able to play that, even on Fox News, the way that the somehow he did a couple of photo ops standing in front of cops, and they were like, oh, he's a Law and Order guy. I mean, he's not really a Law and Order guy.
Nothing, yeah. He's a just, party. He likes to go to parties.
Exactly. But he was able to, just because he wasn't anti-cop, the way that there were so many Democrats who were basically like they were the defund the police types. And all you got to do now to be essentially a Law and Order Democrat is to not say defund the police, right?
Right. I mean, I, you know, now we're in New York City. We have so many issues with crime. It's everyone's complaining about it of all races, and we need police officers now more than ever.
Yeah,
between the bikes and the subway crimes and all this other crap, we have so much stuff going on, and it's like not the time. It's like we're in chaos. I knew we'd be in a mental health crisis, right? So people, you know, the pandemic happened, and I'm like, we're going to be in the next few years in a mental health crisis. Trust me, and we are. A lot of these crimes that we have are these random, crazy people, you know, stabbing someone, shooting somebody. They're not organized crime for the most part. You know, we hear people getting shoved into the subway. That's a mental health crisis crime.
Yeah.
And so we have no intervention with homelessness. That, you know, we have homeless people more than ever. They're all, you know, and we don't have any interventions. You know, that I ever see. I'm in the city all the time. I'm in the city, you know, for days at a time, and I never see anybody helping the homeless people doing anything. They just let them have their own little huts, and not even huts, like they just sleep under the grating, under the another grate, the you know, the things that, what they call the things that the buildings, they protect the buildings.
Yeah, the awnings.
The awnings. Yeah. And they build, you know, and it's just a problem.
And it's funny because at this, you know, the homeless people, they actually used to get at least lip service. People would say, oh, we got to do something about this. But now when I walk from here across to Grand Central, I have to walk by the Roosevelt Hotel. I mean, it's like the migrant thing. The migrants have taken over all the hotels, and they're basically like spilling out into the street. So you have
they're
now-
not homeless, right? They live in the hotels.
Oh, they live in the hotels. Yeah. So, I mean, talk about an insult to the homeless people. We've been yapping and yapping. Oh, we got to solve this homeless crisis. And now we're like housing like half of South America in the city, and the homeless people are still out in the street.
That's what I don't understand. Like, I don't like that when we use people as pawns, and that's what we do with the migrant crisis, right? We'll take them. We don't have room for them. First of all, we also have upstate New York. Why you would bring migrants into a very crowded metropolis does not make sense.
Yeah.
From an urban planning, right? We have an entire, you know, they really wanted to bring the migrants. They could have said, we'll build them buildings upstate. That would make sense. Why put them in hotels in a very crowded city? It doesn't make sense to me. It's irresponsible.
It's unbelievable.
I get very upset every time I see, like, something happened, like the mayor didn't do something or he did something really dumb. I get so angry.
I was talking to him earlier in my office here. He was talking about how they're going to save money by giving out the food cards to the migrants. You know, he says, because we're cutting out the middleman. We're giving the credit cards directly to the migrants, and then they can go and spend it in the city. I mean, it's crazy. And I think the whole thing was he's getting credit for criticizing the Democrats and saying, Joe Biden, you know, we have a migrant crisis here. And they're all saying, oh, Mayor Adams, he's admitting there's a crisis. But the thing is, he just wants money. He just wants the federal government to come in and give him cash. That's why he's complaining.
And everyone knows people are making money off the migrants because all these contracts, you know, from the hotels to the food services, just like a school, like when you have a school and, you know, I want the contract for their meals. I want the contract for this, you know, especially the charter schools, because I've worked in schools. I do teaching sometimes. And so I see some of these charter schools. I'm like, okay, this is a little bit of a, you know, a money grub. I see it. The uniform companies, everyone's making money. So can you imagine how many people are making money from housekeeping to, because they're not using in-house union housekeeping. They're using probably, I don't know who they're using from company, right?
Yeah.
Clothing, cleaning, whatever, anything that would deal with taking care of the migrants, people are making money. And Mayor Adams is probably like, you know, they have, you know, they're going to donate to Eric Adams if he gives them the contract.
How when you ran for mayor, I'm assuming that the biggest pain is fundraising. Like, you got to raise money, right? How did you do it? Did you like go speak at dinners and beg people to support your campaign? Like, how did you get the money?
I didn't have most of the money had to go to ballot access. So a huge amount of money had to go with getting on the ballot, just getting on the ballot. Forget about, you know, making.
Why? Who do you have to pay to get on the ballot?
You don't pay, but you have to get 30,000 signatures.
Okay.
So you hire hundreds of people, whatever, 50 people, hundreds, whatever we had to hire, to go out in the pandemic and ask people, they need to be registered voters, to sign their name, the address. You know, it has to be specifically registered voters within the city of New York,
yep.
I believe. 30,000 of them, or whatever. It's a lot of, even 15, it's a lot of people. I think it was 30,000. So then what happens then is you have it, and you only have like months and months. You only have like 1 month or 2 months to do it, maybe. So it's all very crammed in. So it's like you're out there, then you're asking for money, and you're, you know, I'm all day long, I'm like, hi, this is, I'm talking to people myself, asking people for money.
Yep.
Oh, would you like to give $200 today for a party that won't win? I mean, you're selling an ideology, essentially, right? You're not, you know, if I was a Democrat or Republican, you know, they know what they're getting. Libertarians are, we've never won an election, you know, especially a mayoral run or a gubernatorial run, nothing, right?
Yes.
You've never had a, you know, major part, you know, a major office, really, within the city. So you're selling this idea of liberty and freedom. And so that's what I was selling. So when someone gave me $200 or $2,000, it was because they believed in the cause. It was really coming from here.
Yeah. And when you were all done, was there any money left in a bank account, was there like a debt?
We owed some people, I think, our fundraising company at the time, they took a big percentage. So if we didn't raise that much money, and it was a lot. It was a lot. I mean, and you have to account for everything. You have a treasurer and everything's accounted for. I can't go buy, you know, out to dinner and everyone thinks you just take them. No, everything's accounted for. I didn't even, you know, I don't make money. I lost money, you know, on the whole, you know, because I didn't work. You know, I didn't really work those years. You know, I was that year I had to campaign. So
yep.
I basically would do private shows on the DL, right? Because, you know, I would do like these private shows up in like different places in private homes. And that was it. And I was basically begging people to, you know, fund my campaign. You know, I had a campaign, I had other people asking for money. Like if you look at old podcast, Larry Sharp and I would try to raise money on his podcast. And that's how we did it. And everything gets accounted for. And, you know, but we weren't a rich campaign by any means, but anyone who did give money gave because they believed in the libertarian cause and the libertarian ideologies.
Yeah. But you did have a fundraising group that works like on a percentage. So they raise a bunch of money and then they take a little chunk. Is that right?
Not a little chunk, but yes, they do.
They take a lot.
A lot of money.
because I used to do telemarketing back in when I lived in the Cambridge area. And I remember being marveling at the fact that the group that I worked for, it was a private telemarketing company. We took most of the money.
Like yeah, most the same thing. It was the same thing.
Yeah.
I would call up it, you know, and I was good at it. Like I would get people to like, hey, hi, Stacey, I'm the mayoral candidate. I'm the Libertarian mayor. I'm so great to meet you. I really want to bring liberty into our city, you know, and the lockdowns. You want to help out my campaign? How does $200 sound? And they're like, one guy's like, I'll give you 2000. I'm like, okay. Cause you have, you know, a limit. I think it's like 2000 or 2500 per person.
Right.
So we had some really great donors and people that kept giving every month. So, you know, we didn't raise a lot of money, but enough to get on the ballot. And if anybody ever runs for office, getting on the, especially a big office, getting on the ballot is very hard because you get challenged. So other parties will challenge you.
So they look at the signatures and they say, this one's fake. This one's fake.
Well, not the Board of Elections, but for instance, like GOP or the Democrats would be like, they would challenge us. And then, you know, we had like my campaign manager, who was an ultimate genius, fought the challenges and we won. We got on the ballot. And that alone, that to me, when, you know, other than obviously if I won the election, that was one of the hugest hurdles to go over is getting on the ballot. So it's not so easy. That's a challenge for a third party or independent.
Let me know if you know the answer to this, because in the local election or the New York election, I was voting for Westchester County Supervisor, you know, because I live in Yonkers on the Yonkers-Bronxville line, okay? And so I wanted to make sure I was not only voting for the state elections, you know, because I wanted to vote against Kathy Hochul and all that, but I wanted to vote for a couple of Westchester County executives. So I went to my local election and I noticed something that you have so-and-so Republican, so-and-so Democrat. Okay. Now, if I don't know who they are, I'm just going to vote Republican because I'm conservative. Okay. But a lot of people were like Republican, Democrat, and then there was the conservative line. And you would think like, oh, I'm conservative. Maybe I'll just vote for the conservative. But then I looked and the conservative was actually the Democrat. They got on the conservative line. And then there was the liberal line. And she got on the liberal line as well. So she was on liberal, conservative, Democrat. She was on all three. And I said, oh, this whole thing's a scam.
You can do that. You can do that. So basically, there's a conservative party. I don't know. I didn't know there was a liberal party. It's not called.
There's a liberal party too.
Was it, are you sure it wasn't libertarian?
There is a liberal party and it said liberal.
I didn't know that. And that was, that's point, just an independent thing. That's just independent. Then it's just a made up party.
But one
it's
of
like, the rent is too high kind of guy.
Yeah. But one in one point, the conservative, and there was a Republican, and there was a Republican who was also on the liberal line, and there was a Democrat who was on the conservative line. So it just, they kind of pull a scam where they just get on as many as they can, whether they,
well,
you know,
yeah,
or not.
So, for instance, like, I think in my mom's district, when I went to help, there was a libertarian, there wasn't an individual libertarian, let's say, I don't know, a senator or whatever it was, or whoever, or representative, it was, they were Democrat and a libertarian.
Yeah.
So you can do, you could be, I think it's called Wilson Bakula, you can be on two. So you can be on the major party and then do a secondary party. Because like, they'll take you, right? Like they'll take, and you know, the conservative party would probably have the Republican, but maybe she was a stronger candidate for the conservative party. So they gave her the endorsement. It's about getting the endorsement.
Yeah.
Those third parties, some of them are like BS and some of them are real.
Yeah.
I never heard of the liberal party at all. So it might as well be, you know, but the libertarian party is the third largest party and they take both Democrats and Republicans because they kind of have a different philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very interesting.
And there's also a Democrat Socialist Party. It's a totally different party.
Right. And there's, I don't see it as, I didn't see it in this last election, but there's obviously there's a Green Party. And right. Was there a Green candidate this round for mayor? No.
This is interesting about how our city ran. So Eric Adams is a Democrat. He had a lot of votes. Then Curtis Lee Wobb was a Republican. He had not so many votes. And then the third party that was, had quite a significant amount of votes for a third party was the Democratic Socialist girl, and then the conservative, and then the libertarian.
Wow.
I mean, that's, she had significantly more than the cop guy. Not Sliwa, the other guy, Bill Pepitone.
Yep.
So, you know, it was funny. We all became kind of, I started knowing a lot of the candidates. You know, some of them are really wonderful people, like Paperboy Prince. He was really fun. He was like, let's love each other. You know, everyone had like, you know, this gentleman, Raja Flores, who was, his whole thing was that he wants to get rid of asbestos, you know, and he had, because he was a head of like lung surgery or they were at, in one of the big hospitals. So
yeah.
There was a very interesting people running for mayor when I ran. So yeah. It was fun.
So would you do it again?
I don't know if I'd run for the same office because I think that's a bad luck, but I'd run for an office, probably a congressperson or a senator. Yeah. That would be the next, I would like a national office, but I want to be really ready for it. I don't want to do it out of, you know, for the wrong reasons. I want to make sure everything, all my ducks are in a row. I'm up on all the politics. I understand what's going on. I want to be very, very much in the know before I do it. I want to, you know, really understand the issues. Like I'm the kind of person that investigates. I want to investigate everything, understand it, you know, get all the information and then go for it.
Yeah. Well, I'm encouraged. I mean, that's interesting because having gone through it, I almost would have thought that like the cynicism would have kicked in and be like, I would never do that again. That was a total nightmare. Like the whole deck is stacked against you. You know,
it's
all set up. The establishment runs everything. But you, the fact that you would do it again and for another office, I think that's great.
I would do it. I know all my mistakes. First of all, you make all these mistakes. I would have started my fundraising earlier. I would have been more aggressive with the fundraising. I would have, you know, used every sort of, you know, every single thing that I could possibly think of to get people on my team.
Yeah.
In terms of helping out, I would have definitely fundraised before I started fundraising. You know, year or two before. This way, I can hire a great team. I would get commercials out there, you know, totally much different than I did it. But I know my mistakes. You know, I think I was, you know, I understand what to do, right? Because like I didn't know what I was doing. I was like really a fish out of water.
Yeah.
And it was big office, you know, and I took on a lot. But I think doing a little bit smaller office or a senator or something, a small district or something would be better. I don't know if everyone's like, you should do city council, but I don't really want to stay in the city. So I want to be able to broaden into like more of a national, I wouldn't mind being in DC for a while.
Do you know Vicky Palladino? I talked to her on a recent podcast.
I don't know her well. I know the name.
Vicky Palladino. She's one of the few, I don't know how many, but there's only a small handful of Republicans on the city council and she's one of them.
Oh, wow. Okay. There's not a lot. Yeah. They wouldn't let me. You know, I'm kind of very middle of the road. Like my views are very middle of the road. You know, I'm kind of right in the middle, right? So I don't fall too much on some issues are left, some issues right. Like it depends on the issue, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of the city council, they wouldn't even let me speak at their meetings.
Right.
Not city council. But community board. Sorry, I couldn't forget the
community board. I see.
Yeah, I had some issues with the community because they're so like set in their ways, and you know.
Yeah, I would imagine. I mean, community boards have to be just very liberal, right? Because it just seems like a left-wing entity. You know, it's almost like community organizers, right?
Or they're very controlled, you know, but they want, you know, right? They're very controlling. And
yeah.
The people that yell at you in the elevator, you know?
They
might be people that would be on a co-op board.
Yep. Yeah.
When do you shower? When's your, you know, what time do your visitors come? Do you drink wine? Do you eat slime? I mean, that's what they remind me of. It's like too much in your business.
We were in a co-op in Bronx, in Riverdale, for years.
Sorry to hear it.
But yeah, and I would occasionally go to the meetings, but and I would vote for who I thought was the good person. But yeah, they're in your business, that whole board. It was a total nightmare. I'm glad that I'm now a homeowner and I don't have to deal with
that. Way. Yeah, that's why I don't like dorm rent. I don't like that kind of feeling. I always wanted to. I grew up in like a private house. Like I never wanted to have too many people in my apartment building. I lived in it with a dorm room. I hated it. I felt they were spying on me. And I'm not paranoid. I just don't like the idea of people knowing your comings and goings. And just, it doesn't make me feel safe.
Yeah.
I'd rather just have like cameras, you know, like in my house or something.
Oh, and thank God we got out of that building. We were in a small co-op building. I mean, it was a small co-op building, but it was also a small apartment. But we got out of there just before the pandemic. Can't imagine what it would have been like in that building with all the lunatics in there during the pandemic, when I just wanted to live my life, you know? So we got out of there in time, and we got to our house in Yonkers. And so it was great.
That's a great area. I love Yonkers. Like, I have family that was from Yonkers and Upper Westchester. It's beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, where I say it says Bronxville on my mail because I'm in the
Fancy.
Fancy, but we actually are on the Yonkers side, so we pay the Yonkers taxes. So we kind of get the best of both worlds there.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I love Westchester. Is a great, great suburb of New York City.
Yeah,
I mean, it's really good. I mean, I think that like New York is so divided, and now people are like, we need more cops. You know, it's like the strange thing what is happening now. You know, it's. Yeah.
Oh, it's going to come back in a big way, you know, with this migrant thing. I mean, I feel like your average left-wing Democrat is now starting to like drift because they've had it, you know?
They've had it. I mean, yeah, everyone's like very left-wing until it like's in their backyard, right? It's like, you know, everyone's very woke until it affects their life, you know? So like, it's like, that's what people are. They're selfish. They're in some ways... You know, and I think that people get confused with like real empathy and being woke. And that was the thing that always bothered me, like sort of like virtue signaling and really caring about people are two very different things.
Yeah.
And I think that when people sort of like really care, they really do things. When they virtue signal, they're just pain in the butt. That's just my opinion.
Yeah. So I want to plug your podcast that's upcoming. You said it's going to debut at the end of February.
Yeah, the end of February, called The Pressman Hour. Go to my website, stacypressman.com or stacycomic.com. Follow me on social media, all at Stacy Pressman. Donate to my podcast. I want to do it in studio because, you know, I love the idea of having a studio and doing it from like a studio in the city where people could come and I can get guests and feel comfortable, because I've been doing podcasts out of my home for so long. So I think it'd be fun doing a studio. And I want to get some ads out so people know what's coming. So if you can, donate what you can, $5, $10, $6, whatever you can.
That's great. And what do you do, Patreon?
No, it's actually just go to my website. It's a Square donation link on my website.
That's great. That's great. So, all right. And then it'll be on all the things. It'll be on Spotify and Apple.
Everything. Yeah. So I want to, you know, have to pay producers and all the things to pay. You have to pay all these links and all that stuff. So guys, donate, you know, it's fun. It'll be fun. I have some great guests coming, and hopefully Tom will be on the show.
I would love it.
It'll be awesome. And we're going to have a good time. So it's going to be a little different. It's not going to be shock jock. I'm talking to people of all walks of life that no one else is talking to. So I'm really excited about that, because I've done the whole shock jock thing. I've done some political stuff. We're going to just learn about different things, talk about really interesting people that no one's talked to in a while. So I'm really psyched about it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I do this. I mean, I got my job, I got the Fox, whatever, but I like doing this just as my personal project, because I just like to have a place where I can just talk and you know, not worry.
And I just want to thank you. When I was on Red Eye, my dad ended up passing away very soon after, a few months later, and he was so proud.
Oh,
and I met I with you, and he was like, when are you going to be doing it again? And he was like, I had a ventilator. I'm like, oh, soon. And, you know, the show closed and my dad died. But I wanted to thank you for that.
Oh, yeah. And you would have been you would have been a regular on it if we had just stayed on the air.
I know. I wish you would have. My friends loved it. They all watched it. And, you know, it's TV, right? It's show business, but it's
show
great
biz.
What you're doing now. Yeah.
We'll keep him busy, and hopefully there'll be some Fox Nation projects coming up soon, and I'd love to have you.
I'd love to do it.
That's great.
Well, thank you.
All right. Stacy Pressman.
Bye, guys. Thank you. Bye. Thank you, Tom.